Recently, I was at a meeting, there was discussion, since Bob Dickey had passed away, about some of the things that Bob liked to do and muse about. I got to spend a while at Princeton and was his next-door neighbor, and among other things, we'd talk a bit about large number hypotheses. And he was fond of pointing out that some of these numbers were quite curious. For example, one could calculate the number of baryons, approximate number of baryons in the universe by taking some ratios of constants. Whether or not relevant is another matter, but one could at least muse about it. Dirac was also quite fond of these kinds of numerologies. One thing that's actually interesting to cosmology now is that if one calculates the so-called Planck temperature, we get about 10 to the 32 Kelvin or 10 to the 19 GeV. And if we start the universe off rolling from this time with this temperature and say, let's assume the Big Bang starts at 10 to the minus 43 seconds with the temperature of 10 to the 32 Kelvin, throw in microphysics, namely in radiation-dominated era, it decays like T to the minus 1/2 till you enter the matter-dominated era. You lo and behold get something which is not too far away from what we see today. Of course, you don't predict it very well, but it's incredible that it's not that far off. So Bob actually liked to imbibe once in a while, and I thought another thing one could do is actually calculate the number of baryons based on the... Anyway, here we are. Okay, so what's actually quite curious, depends on the size of the Coors bottle, 12 ounce or 16 ounce. Right? one can hopefully determine the cosmological parameters from the CMB, and this, those of you that have followed this at all know this is a pretty exciting possibility. As we discussed at a meeting we had here several months ago, it looks like a realistic possibility. And the input, of course, comes from the rather early history of the universe when the universe is extremely hot, the photons, the baryons, dark matter all interacting in some dance, and the imprint of the cosmological parameters actually gets directly stuck into the background radiation, at least in theory. Okay, so the imprinting actually happens well before our surface of last scattering when the photons and the electrons last interacted, but actually the physics that goes on during this period also gets imprinted, and the whole combination is something that we hope to be able to ultimately pull out. Of course, there are other ways of determining cosmological parameters, and by parameters I mean things like the Hubble parameter currently, the density, the baryon fraction, any fraction that might be in the cosmological constant. Wendy Friedman put together a nice summary, 97, and basically you get to believe that the best estimator for density from optical measurements, not from the CMB, from optical measurements, is something around a mega of 0.3 or so. And if you talk to Wendy or Netta Bacall, who's here recently, they would say it's 0.3 plus or minus 0.1. It is not 1. Okay? Now, other methods are not so constraining, and neither do I necessarily believe that that's the case, but certainly the data that they have is consistent with that, given the model. The CMB currently, as you'll see, does not give us a great estimate, although we believe that's about to change in the next 5 years. Other types of measurements, supernova in particular, particularly very high Z measurements, yield some very tantalizing measurements, which I think are way too premature, but I believe in the long run they're going to be something that has to be compared with the CMB. Just to give you an idea, the HST key project on H-naught, at least the last I saw, was about 70. And depending on how you want to add your systematic errors, either in quadrature or linearly, has a pretty respectable error, something of the order of 10%, maybe even less. Again, I think we're not quite there yet, but we're not talking about 100 anymore. What seems to be happening, as you all know, is that you get to larger and larger angular scales, going from galaxies to clusters of galaxies to gravitational lenses to very distant supernovas. One gets somewhat different estimators for the cosmological parameters, in particular the mass fraction and any omega lambda. The CMB is unique in that it really probes scales which are far beyond anything we can see in the optical. We're really going back much, much further. And basically, we're looking at gravitational perturbations where the temperature maps the gravitational perturbations, at least in the simplest of models. Okay, we're at delta T over T, which is the temperature difference in the sky that my measure is of the order of the difference in the gravitational potential over C squared. Typically, we see this, of course, is of the order of 10 to the minus 5, which tells us what the velocity distributions are roughly like. We can put this in terms of delta rho over rho and express it slightly differently in terms of a sum in k-space. And as you'll see, some of the plots are given as in k-space rather than in physical space. Okay. For the CMB itself, we expand the distribution on the sky as a map, just like we would for a map of any other structure on the sky, in terms of spherical harmonics, and relate the power in a given mode in terms of the ALMs, where we average over the azimuthal mode M. And then the correlation function is simply related to the ALMs, or the CLs, by essentially a power times a mode function. And we expand the sky in terms of those modes. The reason the azimuthal functions are not as relevant is that we're only looking at a particular universe, not a global ensemble of universes that we have access to. We only have access to one. Okay. Okay. So in a scale invariant spectrum, one goes roughly down like 1 over L times L plus 1. Or if we multiply by L plus 1, we have roughly scale invariance. Okay, just to give you a quick idea of sizes here, if we're looking at something of the order of an angular scale of 10 degrees, we're looking at something which is roughly a gigaparsec in size. Okay, so for something of the order of a megaparsec, we're on the order of arc minutes. So those things in the sky which are megaparsec in scale, which is obviously larger than our galaxy, but typical of the distance, say, from here to Andromeda, we would be looking at angular scales of order arc minute or so. Okay, well, one of the great virtues of being a theorist is you can sit in an office and draw pretty pictures all day. Not to belittle the great work of Wayne Hu and Sugiyama and Joe Silk, but there's some just absolutely gorgeous pictures that have been put on the web and in the publications recently. Basically pointing out that if one looks at the photon baryon fluid as an oscillating fluid, one can pull out the anisotropies in terms of the compression and rarefactions in this fluid. And it's a very nice model and gives us some qualitative understanding of what's happening in the sky when we look at these ALMs. Okay. So this again is due to Wayne Hu. What you see is that the power spectrum one would predict depends on the parameters that you put into the model, not unexpected. And the key is, if we can measure the power spectrum with some precision, then we can pull out the cosmological parameters that come in to the model. The problem comes in is this unique, and is it not degenerate? Okay, well, to have it be unique, one has to have enough data to map the spectrum out sufficiently precisely and with small enough error bars that, in fact, you're not confused as to whether you're looking at a baryon fraction that's changing or an omega lambda that's different or H is different, as not to mention whether you have reionization in the universe. So from the experimentalist point of view, this comes down to measuring the correlation function or the CLs, the power, sufficiently accurately. And in a world where we have no noise, where we're only limited by the so-called cosmic variance, then we would estimate an uncertainty in the CL fractional error as simply going down like the square root of L, 1 over the square root of L. Okay, but in practice, where you have noise in the system, it's much more complicated. In addition, the sky is not perfectly uniform in terms of our ability to view it. And so when we have to throw in the fact that we can only look at part of the sky which is free of galactic emission or free of extragalactic sources, the fact that our beam size is not infinitely small, and the fact that we have finite noise, the issue becomes much more complicated. Ideally, in the end, when we measure the power spectrum, we'll be able to lay our plot down and say which of the various models with which of the parameters fits the power spectrum properly. And what's shown here are some plots of how the various parameters come into play. For example, the z-axis on each of these is the power spectrum LL plus 1 times CL, where we're varying various parameters, mass fraction and baryons, total matter fraction, the curvature, and omega lambda. And what's not so clear from this is, of course, in particular, how does it vary in detail? And as we'll see later, we'll be able to measure some of these parameters to the few percent level, and perhaps even to a fraction of percent level, if all goes well.
It's the same for all four?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so you can see, but the horizontal axis is I see, so you can directly compare the contributions.
Right. And this is just qualitative, gives you a qualitative understanding. And this is not the way that one compares the data to the model, but simply gives one a qualitative understanding of what the model does. But the real problem comes when you actually compare the data to the model, not so much generating models, but when you have real data and ask, can you distinguish between the models? So here I show a plot of several models, H equals 50, H equals 70, spectral indices either 1 or close to 1. And then a string and texture model prior to strings giving a peak in the spectrum. Of course, the theories change with time. And one can see, certainly from the data that I plotted so far, which in bold is our own data plus the COBE data, and lighter points are other people's data, and I'll show a more recent version of those in a bit, is that you would say, yes, the spectrum is rising, but no, you cannot distinguish at all between the various models, with perhaps the exception of this string model, okay, or perhaps the tilted model.
So why is there such a big difference between the green and the, what is it, brown?
This is a tilted spectrum model.
Okay. One is 0.85, the other is 0.94.
Right.
There's a big difference.
Right. Well, there's a big difference between, the difference between 1 and 0.94 is much less than the difference between 1 and 0.85. Is obvious why the model should be so different?
No, it's very sensitive to n, but less sensitive as you go towards n.
That's right, because n equals 1 is the tilt of the spectral index, which here is 0.94 is only 6% away from 1, which is a very small effect. But by the time you get out to 50% away, there's a huge effect in the tilt of the spectrum at large L.
So this is the plot that tells people that strings and textures are ruled out?
No. Unfortunately, a couple years ago, one would have said strings were ruled out. Now, textures is another issue, but the question is, from this plot, you would say, yes, strings were completely ruled out, right, because the power was too high at larger L. But recently there's been some work where one can seem to produce a bump in strings, but still doesn't fit the data. Okay, at least in my mind, it doesn't fit the data. Okay, now, it doesn't seem like at the moment you can get secondary bumps with strings. You can perhaps get a primary bump, okay, but it doesn't quite look like this. So has everyone given up and gone away? I think the texture people have largely thrown up their hands, as far as I can tell, and maybe someone in the audience knows. Okay. I think the string people are still struggling, but part of the problem is this: the rest of the data is not such a great fit either. You know, if one asks, for example, if one goes to the optical, if you overlay the CMB data with the optical data and say, how does the CMB and the optical data fit together, you would say, well, it's not bad to first order. Certainly a cold dark matter model is a reasonable fit to the background radiation data, which is shown. And here we change the scale from L to K. Right? So certainly it looks like a reasonable fit, at least to the precision of the experiment, which is admittedly not great. But when you go to look at the optical data, you would say, well, it's not a great fit to the optical data because the optical data has relatively small error bars for small scales on the sky, right? And you say, no, it's not a good fit to this data. The question is, does any reasonable model fit both sets of data simultaneously? And
but
So the optical data you're comparing to here is what distributes the clusters?
Yes, these are basically optical surveys of galaxies and looking at correlations between various clusters of galaxies. Right. So they overlap at, you know, angular scales here, which are, this angular scale is of the order of, say, 20 arc minutes or so, 30 arc minutes. Okay. So the optical data comes all the way out, which is amazing, all the way out to, you know, the order of a degree or so. But by the time you get out to degree, you get to getting to the plate scale of the optical data. Okay, so the errors begin to blow up. At smaller scales, it's a reasonable fit, but it looks like there's too much power predicted on the scales, and you don't see it.
Okay. So this covert matter without a tilt.
Yeah. Right.
So it's one of these things which fit very well on the graph you had two transparencies ago. Or these bets.
Well, these are, yeah. I mean, this is not just an arbitrary model. This is a reasonable fit trying to adjust things slightly. Okay, this is omega equals 1, Baron fraction 10%. And you can play with that. You can add a little bit of hot dark matter with the cold dark matter to get, you know, lukewarm dark matter.
What was interesting is, and what Tony was also pointing out, is that if you tilt cold dark matter, the fit on the large scales to microwave background seems to go to
yes, fit. Goes to pot. Right. So that's probably not a great solution. Now, what if you add, say, lambda? Does that help? And there, it looks like you get a little better fit, maybe substantially better fit to the optical data, although it still doesn't fit the peak very well.
But
yeah. So it's omega equals 1, lambda equals 0.6, mega matter 0.4. I think it's, you know, it's premature to muse what the actual universe is, but the fact that we're even on the same plot, I find to be quite remarkable. And over the next decade, as we'll see, the error bars on these are going to shrink to roughly the size of the line. The width of the line, and then we'll have an enormous amount of data that will come out. And the optical surveys are going to get substantially better when you have the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, things like that. Okay. Okay, so this is the current quilt as of last month. Now, thing one has to be very careful about here is that the more experiments you add, the more complicated the quilt gets. And so you'd say from your eye that, well, anything will fit that because I have so much stuff to, the errors are so large. But just like any statistically meaningful experiment, what you really should be doing, if you believe all the experiments are good estimators of the parent distribution, is average the data set together. Okay. So from this, these are the raw data sets shown for the given experiment in different colors. Okay, and you can see it's, you know, a reasonable fit to an omega equals 1 model, but then it's a reasonable fit to, you know, omega equals 0.3 model too, based on what your eye perceives. If we get a little more sophisticated about it and average these together, I'll just jump ahead. So basically the same data set shown here. Okay, where now we average the data sets together and say all the data sets are equally meaningful statistically, and I'll just average via their statistical errors. In other words, I believe that they're all good estimators. And then you would say, well, maybe it's a little more interesting. Again, we have clear evidence for a rise in the spectrum, right, just like I showed you before. But now maybe we even have evidence for a drop in the spectrum. And the experimental community still does not agree on this at all, but it is tantalizing that perhaps we see that. Okay, the real weight comes in two significant points. The rise in spectrum, I basically would say that we all agree on. The peak point, we don't agree on. This point, there's only one experiment, and really there's only one at the peak, too. So I would say we're still unconvinced by this. These are the groups that produced it. They said this is very preliminary.
So the fact that peak was so much higher than the curve,
yeah, it is, because clearly this is not a good fit to the model. Mm-hmm. Now, you can try to fit the model a little more aggressively with the cosmological constant. You can raise the height of the peak if you want. The problem you still have is that the error bars are sufficiently large that by the time you're done, you have very large uncertainties. But you would say from this that omega equals 1 standard model is not a good fit.
Well, how do you think this is a variable?
Those are one sigma error bars. Actually, in this case, no, I think these are two sigma error bars. Sorry.
One sigma, that'd be a pretty good
error. Yeah, no, I think these are actually two sigma. Well, the question is the power in the peak, if you view this as a single point, is the power in that peak significantly larger than the model peak? And the answer is that, yes, it is significantly larger. In other words, if you ask, how robust is the fit to this model versus, say, an omega lambda model, this one is excluded at fairly large significance. But, again, this is very limited data set, very small fraction of sky. Okay, and there are lots of possibilities that it could be wrong. So.
The model is n equal 1.
Yes.
Solberg measure. H
yes.
doesn't matter.
Well, H matters. H is
not much.
A little bit, but not too. Well, I mean, to the extent of the error bars here, it doesn't matter at all, of course.
Yeah.
But yes, it does still matter. Okay. Well, that's basically where we are today. Of course, with the COBE satellite, we only were able to determine things that are roughly the order of the size of your fist if you held it out at arm's length. Turns out to be about the beam size of COBE, which is roughly 7 degrees, just kind of fist size. Okay, and what we see here are, of course, only the very lowest L's are showing up. So if I ask on this plot, where is COBE? COBE is basically this point and this point, and that's it. Okay, all the other experiments here, which unfortunately, if we had known ahead of time what we were going to find, we would have designed COBE completely differently, but we didn't know, even though if we'd see anything. But obviously, where you really want to measure is at much higher angular scales, which means instead of having an antenna the size of my hand, or even smaller, for example, the smallest antenna on COBE, the differential microwave radiometer, is about that large, okay, roughly a couple inches. And ideally, what you really want is something which is about 8 feet in diameter. Okay. So, for example, this is a rendition of what the sky might look like simulated with the COBE beam size here, where we smoothed to 7 degrees of angular resolution, versus something which is smoothed to, say, 5 to 10 arc minutes of angular resolution. And obviously you see enormously more detail than you see at 7 degrees. Okay, it turns out that just modeling the sky at the angular scales that you want to, namely the order of, say, 5 arc minutes, a tenth of a degree, which is roughly 100 times smaller than we had on COBE, in itself is very difficult. This is a flat model, omega equals 1, no cosmological constant, due to Chris Gorski, where he's basically mapped the entire sky at high resolution. One of the problems you immediately find is that if you want to pixelize in something that has 10th degree pixels and you want to do the whole sky, you have more pixels than you can put on a piece of paper easily. So just presenting the data in these future generation of experiments is going to be a difficulty. But if one asks, can one tell the difference? If I were to put two maps up and say which one is the flat model and which is the open model, you'd immediately look at them and say, the open model has more high-frequency structure to it. You don't have to do any analysis. You would look at them. Now, of course, it's a question of how open is the model. Is it omega equals 0.9 or is it omega equals 0.3? This is more like omega equals 0.3. So, yes, you could just look at the map and immediately you could, you know, a six-year-old could say which of these is an open universe and which of these is a flat universe. Right? Okay. Well, unfortunately, there are complications that occur and will occur. I mean, this is a map. We would love to have this map. Probably never in, at least in my lifetime, will we have that kind of map. Because we live inside of a galaxy which is not so benign. This is a map, for example, of what dust emission looks like as taken from the COBE Derby, which is a diffuse infrared background experiment, between 100 and 240 microns. And what you see is that the sky is a very complicated mixture of dust emission, which is primarily in the plane of the galaxy, but also extends very significantly off the plane. Okay, so on this map, if I were to put up the same kind of sky and ask, course, the projections are unfortunately different, but ask what fraction of the sky would be available for me to look at, I would definitely have to avoid the plane of the galaxy and even go so far as perhaps cut out a lot of the material that I see in other maps. The problem comes in that we don't know what's far off the galactic plane from other processes. And this is why most of the experiments which are being designed today have to have their own ability to cut or to allow us to cut data which is going to be contaminated. For example, if I go even shorter in wavelength, out to 10 microns or so, we see the same kind of structure, namely a lot of emission concentrated in the plane of the galaxy, but then a lot of other emission here which doesn't look anything like the plane of the galaxy. And this is dust not in our galaxy, well it is, but dust in our solar system. So for example, just the plane of the ecliptic contributes a significant amount of dust. Now luckily, we don't think that this is going to be a big problem for CMB, but the previous one will be a huge problem, namely dust from the galaxy. Well, there are other things to worry about. This is neutral hydrogen, which is one that we don't understand very well. This is probably the one we have the poorest understanding of in terms of our concern about the CMB. We know there's a lot of neutral hydrogen around. The problem is, how do you find it? If you look in the visible, look for visible transitions, you can map it out pretty well. But there may be neutral hydrogen which is not visible at optical wavelengths, but will still show up in the microwave region. And there are other things there. This is carbon. There's nitrogen. Some of these have emission lines that we have to be concerned about. Okay. So in the end, what we hope to produce ideally is a series of maps where we can uniquely cut each of these contaminants, and one's contaminant is another person's jewel. Right? So for example, the detector noise, which most people would throw away in the garbage, you know, to someone who's really into detector noise, they might say, oh, that's really interesting. You know? Unfortunately, some of us have to live in that regime. As you can see, anyway, you can look at this and you can say, is it random or is it not random? Does it look random? No, it doesn't look random. Right? It has stripes to it, right?
What are the axes you can tell us
looking at? Well, it really doesn't matter what the axes are, but if you want to think of it, you could think of right ascension declination. It's just a cut of the sky. It makes no difference here. This is for pedagogical reasons. Okay. But you can see that the detector noise that we predict we will have, this is a prediction for the Planck satellite, is not going to be random. There will be stripes from the fact that detectors drift with time, the fact that the instrument does not rotate fast enough to close the drift leads to striping. There's dust emission, there's synchrotron emission. Okay, there are galaxies both in the infrared and in the radio. Okay, there's emission from hot gas around clusters of galaxies. All these things which we would sometimes rather not have, although they have their own science in them, ultimately at the bottom is the cosmology that we'd like to understand. Okay, but we have to work our way. We have to fight through all of these different contaminants to get to the bottom. Okay, well, so far, nature has been relatively kind to us. In fact, 10 years ago when we started our work from Santa Barbara, we had no idea what the level of many of these things were. And now we have a much better idea. So just to give you an idea of where we're headed, this is a plot of the kind of sensitivity that one can achieve with the Planck experiment. I'll show you the MAP experiment in a moment. This is noise per resolution element in roughly 15 months in microkelvins. And remember that the background radiation is about 3 Kelvin, so 3 microkelvin would be one part in a million. Whereas the structures that we're typically looking at least 10 times larger than that in some areas and of that order in others. But this is per pixel, and you have lots of pixels in the sky. Okay. So in the so-called new Planck experiment, where we've revamped things to be even more sensitive, we will get down to a order 1 times 10 to the minus 6 in the best channel for angular scales of order. This is now down around 10 arc minutes. Okay. So there are There are currently two spacecraft missions which are going to be launched in the next decade. The first one to be launched will be a NASA mission called MAP, which is the Microwave Anisotropy Probe. It's a lot like COBE in that the instrument is differential. So on COBE, we basically looked at two parts of the sky that were roughly 60 degrees apart, and we spun the spacecraft around and made a map of the sky by inverting a matrix. Here the idea is very similar, except instead of the antenna being the size of my hand, it's now roughly the size of the old satellite dishes that you used to have in your backyard. Of course, now they're much smaller. So this instrument is designed to be cooled in space radiatively. It goes out to one of the Lagrange points, out to L2. Is designed to observe for at least 1 year, and I hope that it will observe for several years. It won't be as sensitive as the Planck instrument. Planck instrument, remember, gets down to about 1 times 10 to the minus 6 per pixel. This will be of the order of 5 times less sensitive, maybe 10 times less sensitive, and with the beam size, which is roughly 3 times the beam size of the Planck instrument, at least 3 times the smallest beam size of the Planck instrument. Okay, so it won't be as good, but it's going to get there first in terms of space instrument, and it should do a great job. I'll show you some of the power spectrum one might expect in a moment. I'll show you both sets. The European community, along with some of us in the U.S., have worked on an instrument called, previously called Cobra Samba, which is now called Planck, called the Planck Explorer. And instead, if you remember with the MAP instrument, having two sets of antennas, here's the two antennas, these are re-imaging optics. There is one antenna, and that's the fundamental difference. If you want to ask what's the difference between the two, this is a single, this is a Cyclops experiment, and this is a, you know, a two-eyed experiment. And those of us in the community fight back and forth about which is better in the end. Hopefully it won't matter, and they'll both work sufficiently well. I'm sorry, this was out of order. The reason you want to go to higher and higher sensitivity and smaller beam sizes is shown pretty well here, where you see qualitatively, this is from a satellite that we proposed that didn't make it through the cut, but as you go down from, say, 30 arc minutes to 15 arc minutes to 8 arc minutes of beam size, and as you change the noise level from 100 microkelvin to 10 microkelvin, and remember on Planck we hope to get to 3 microkelvin, you can see the relative uncertainty, so this would be a 1% error, on omega naught, omega baryon, and n is dropping very rapidly. This is a logarithmic scale. So if you had an 8 arc minute beam and a 10 arc minute sensitivity per pixel on something of the order of a half the sky or so, you would predict that you would get down well below 1% in estimating the cosmological parameters, which, of course, would be spectacular, considering that today we don't really know what they are to maybe of order 50%. Where will we be in terms of beam size? Well, the MAP mission will have roughly a 15 arc minute beam. I think their best estimate now for their highest frequency channel is around 13 arc minutes. The Planck mission will have roughly a 5 arc minute beam for the smallest angular scale, to about 4.5. And probably more like 7 or so for the science, best science channel. So you can see that in theory we will be in a regime to predict at least these three plus many other parameters with exquisite precision. Now whether there will be something that gets in our way, we don't know yet. Just as a comparison, you can see delta T over T in microkelvin, okay, whereas before I plotted CL, which is in power, microkelvin squared, but at least I show you the model here so you can compare, is a function of L, which is Legendre polynomial moment. So this L of 100 is roughly of the order of a degree or so. Okay. All right, and you can see that the various experiments, MAP shown in light blue, Planck shown in darker blue, as you get to angular scales which are of order of the beam size, the experiment begins to fall apart in terms of its ability to resolve higher L power spectra. So with Planck, we go out quite a bit further. With MAP, you'll get out at least to the second, and hopefully the third Doppler peak, which is what these are called. And with Planck, we'll get out fourth, fifth, who knows, sixth Doppler peak if it exists. In the meantime, there are other experiments which are going to be flown. And let me show you just show this first by comparison. This again is a reconstruction based on the beam size and sensitivity, although here we're plotting on a linear. Well, the other one's linear too, but you don't actually see it blow up here because I haven't followed out far enough. If I did, you'd see the error bar blow out here. But what you can see is for the map experiment, again, you get out to the first, second, and it sort of blows up at the third Doppler peak. Here you can get out much further. But before Planck flies, which is currently scheduled for 2006, there'll be other experiments that fly, balloon-borne experiments and ground-based experiments. This is one called Top Hat. This is another one called Maxima. And there are others, Boomerang, Beast. And one can see that we should ideally be able to get the first Doppler peak, the second Doppler peak, and maybe the third Doppler peak, we'll have to see, well before the Planck mission flies. Whether it's well before MAP flies, we'll have to see. In theory, yes, but one will have to see. This just shows you, again, the kind of map I showed you before where one now puts in a model and then reconstructs the model and asks, do you reconstruct what you put in correctly? Basically, you're trying to pull out a set of functions which are not completely orthogonal here. So if I put in synchrotron, this is what I pull out of the model. If I put in free-free, this is what I pull out, et cetera. Dust, this is what I pull out. So you can see for some things it works very well. For example, for dust, the model and the reconstruction from the data agree very well. This is, again, from the Planck experiment. Whereas for free-free mission, it works less well, because I have less of a handle in terms of sensitivity and spectral coverage on the free-free emission. Okay. Well, there are other things to look at in terms of the sky. There's the real cosmology itself and the types of galaxies I'd like to look at in detail. So, for example, if I look at clusters of galaxies and ask how well can I resolve clusters of galaxies, it turns out I can reconstruct many, many clusters in the sky. And in itself, the data set that comes out on clusters of galaxies will be spectacular, assuming the model of clusters of galaxies is what we think it is today. But even if it isn't, that in itself will be interesting. Another curious fact is that the wake that a forming structure leaves in the background radiation should be detectable. This is fluctuation in CVR caused by moving clusters. So you have gravitational lensing, right, which is changing with time. The cluster is moving through the field. And it appears as though from recent simulations, and this is a 90 by 90 degree patch, that the peaks in the structure we should see are of order 4 microkelvin. Well, first of all, look at the size here. This is a 90 by 90 degree patch, so there are many, many, many tenth degree pixels in the patch. Each tenth degree pixel will have a sensitivity of order the size of the effect. So you'll be able to average the pixels together, and at least in Planck, we ought to be able to see stuff like this. So there'll be another type of science which will come out. Okay. So the kinds of missions which are planned at the moment, this is just a partial listing. These are future missions. There are balloon-borne missions. There are a number of ground-based missions. There are polarization missions which are planned. And all of them in the next, most of these are due to come to fruition in the next 5 years, whereas MAP is due to launch in late 2001 now, I guess is the, or roughly 2001, depends on the vehicle launch schedule. These are some past and present missions. It's just the field has blossomed in the last 3-4 years. If you look, they're complementary in terms of their angular scale, their frequency range, their sensitivity, their choice of platforms. Some are using balloon platforms. Some are using ground-based platforms. We recently flew an instrument last year to look at smaller angular scales, and for example, one overlays on the COBE map the kind of scales we'd like to go after. We get something like this, where one looks at, instead of a patch of the sky, which is the size of your arm, you're looking at a patch of the sky, which is maybe the size of your pinky. All right, so the goal at the current time is to go in and look at detailed maps on at much smaller angular scales. And just to give you another example here to show you how well we might do in the coming generation of experiments, this is a plot of power spectra versus multipole moment for a couple of different experiments. This is the MAP satellite, and the other is an instrument that we're building in Santa Barbara. And as you can see, if you were just going after power spectrum, if that was the only thing you were going after, there are better ways to get the power spectrum than with the satellite. What this doesn't show you, though, is what else might occur to contaminate the power spectrum. Right, one could certainly get higher sensitivity and better angular resolution so that you might resolve much more precisely the power spectrum than you can with a satellite experiment. But what it doesn't show you is the systematic problems that might occur. So this is just looking in detail out from L of 600 out to L of 2000. You can see the power spectrum blows up on map because of the finite angular size being about 20 arc minutes or 15 arc minutes, whereas one can follow it down much better if you have a smaller beam size. And that's the primary effect, is the beam size. Polarization is another possibility. It turns out that just as the blue sky is polarized in the optical from the anisotropic illumination from the sun, so the background radiation is polarized, linearly polarized from the anisotropic illumination from the background radiation itself. The fact that you have free electrons in the universe allows the anisotropic emission to scatter and produce polarized radiation in very much the same way it does in the sky. So this is another example of what we might be looking for in the next couple of years. So I think I'll conclude a little bit early here. Maybe we could launch into some questions and have a discussion. Within 5 years, I think it's reasonable to say, based on the number of experiments that are going on, that we should have very good estimates, reasonably good estimates of the CMB power spectrum. Namely, we should see the first Doppler peak if it exists, and the second one if it exists at the levels that we think they exist at. All right, this should give us omega baryon, tensor to scalar, tilt, etc., with reasonable errors, maybe 10% errors. Within the next 10 years, we should have really good full sky maps, primarily from the Planck experiment, which should allow us to get to the percent level on these parameters. At that point, I think one can do some serious science in terms of testing whether the inflationary paradigm is reasonable or not, whether there are tensor modes as predicted from inflation. There are other experiments. The satellite experiments will do an okay job on polarization depending on how they're put together. There are other ways to do this that might be better. One can, in fact, look at the ionization history of the universe, which in itself is extremely interesting. And then possibly, and those in the audience would know much more, possibly one can actually invert and pull out the inflaton potential, but I only have seen musings on that and not convinced that it can be done. So I think what I'd like to do is stop there, and maybe we could enter a discussion about what's likely to occur in the next decade or so and entertain some questions.
Questions? Oh.
Yeah, Sean. Well, they both will have, there'll be an effect, right? Certainly in polarization, one will be able to distinguish one from the other. If you look at the predictions for the Planck satellite, I think I actually have this with me, but the prediction on Planck is if we can measure the polarized component properly, and there's a debate now within the scientific group that's working on Planck, whether or not we want to go after polarization, because if you do so, you throw away some photons. Obviously, you take at least a hit of a factor of two from throwing away half the photons. Now, you could add more channels But that's one issue which is being debated at the moment. If we go after polarization in the most sensitive way, we could probably get down to error bars of order, say, 10 microkelvin or so, okay, which in itself would be quite good. There are ways to get much better than that from different type of experiments. You could probably get down to 1 microkelvin or so. That in itself would be an excellent way of distinguishing tensor modes. At the moment, I don't think that we have a good estimator, unless you say that the relationship between tensor and scalar, you know, is related to inflation by, you know, 1 minus n. And I'm not convinced that that's... You'd rather test it, obviously, right.
So without polarization, you have hope of getting this dynamic?
Well, I think it's debatable. You know, I asked that question myself because we're obviously going out designing experiments, and the answers I get back are not, I don't think are satisfactory at this point. I don't think we know enough about the, you know, the possibilities of can we break the degeneracies without it. I mean, if I talk to Paul Steinhardt, I get one answer. If I talk to Dick Bond, I get, you know, somewhat of a different answer. And that's certainly an area of active work.
Yeah.
David had one.
Well, sir, you don't believe that we already know the cosmological constant is not there?
Well, you're referring to the supernova. I'm not convinced. I mean, I don't know if anybody else is convinced that it's... I don't think there's enough data there. I mean, there's not enough supernova have been seen. There's certainly not enough statistics on whether, you know, as a function of redshift you see the effect or not. Yes, it does. You're right. I mean, if I put this back up, all right, the comparison between, say, lambda 0.6 and lambda 0, just with, assuming they're both omega equals 1, you're right, it is a better fit. Which one? Yes. That's correct. Yeah, again, whether one takes a single point as being... This is my plots here. I mean, you're right. That in fact, when that data was first published, one of the issues was, you know, is this evidence for cosmological constant or not? There we go. Right. The peak will rise, right? But what you'd love to see, if that indeed is true, is you'd like to see the detail, and we don't have that. Okay. I'm not convinced at all. I mean, I'm not convinced, but, you know, wait 5 years, and I think we will know the answer to that.
Okay.
Gary?
At the time when their data finally came out, half a year ago, there were persistent rumors about cross-correlation between their emission and COVID signal.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on it?
Yeah, you do see some. Okay. Okay. The question is, if you ask, is the dust emission, which is largely what Derby sees as dust emission, okay, is the dust emission correlated with the anisotropy seen by the DMR? And the DMR obviously sees some dust emission, but very little. Okay. Okay, now I'm not expecting you to see a cross-correlation from the pictures, but the DMR was measuring 31, 53, and 90 gigahertz, or roughly 1 centimeter to 3 millimeters. Okay, the Derby instrument measures roughly from a micron or so out to 240 microns. Okay, so they're looking at very different parts of the frequency spectrum. Question is, do they correlate? And obviously, if you're going to do a correlation, you've got to cut out the plane of the galaxy. Okay, and both of these are in galactic coordinates, and you might say, oh, there's no plane of the galaxy C in the top one, right? Of course, if you know the details of this, there's been a nice airbrushing to remove the plane of the galaxy. Okay. All right, so modulo the airbrushing, which they actually fixed this one up even better than it's normally shown. There's usually a little hole that you see, it's obvious. If you cut, say, both of these at 20 degrees off the plane and you ask, is there a correlation? There is a slight correlation. The question is, what does that do to? And there is some evidence that possibly dust is correlated with neutral hydrogen emission. And if that's the case, and there's also evidence, some evidence from other experiments that may be true. If that's the case, then one has to worry a lot more about the contaminants than we thought. So all I can say is, yes, there is some correlation between them. We don't think it's a major problem for COBE. It could be a major problem for the next generation of CMB, although don't think so, but it's possible. There was some work at Caltech. You remember Tony Reedhead's group went out and looked, and they found some excess emission that seemed to be correlated with dust, even though they're very, very long wavelengths, as though it was neutral hydrogen. Very uncertain now whether that's indicative of anything but a small patch of the sky. Okay, but
is there a revision of COBE normalization? I mean, if you could subtract like 10 or 20%, it might make a difference on small scale. That's what I...
Well, okay, it doesn't make much difference in the,
right,
the COBE data itself. Okay, what we don't know is whether that correlation, because remember, the DMR data is 7 degrees on the sky. The Derby data is smaller. It's about 1 degree. It's about 0.7 degrees, but it's still not close enough to what we're going to be in the next generation, which is smaller than a tenth of a degree on the sky. The answer is we don't know. Okay, we don't have enough data. And unfortunately, the data sets don't exist at this point to answer that question. So the only way we know of to answer that question, besides generating more data sets, is for the instrument itself to have enough channels, enough frequency range to answer that question by itself. So it's not a very satisfactory answer, and I totally agree. You know, I wish I knew the answer myself, because I would worry less about something.
Good question from Gary.
Yeah, you showed a lot of sort of science experiments, both aluminum and ground-based experiments. Is there one which is sort of likely to give a definitive answer to the first Socrates before math?
Yeah, most of them, if you... Well, the list probably looked a little bit bigger than it is. Let me bring the list up again. If I try to answer that in a non-biased way, some of these are they're either very similar to or modifications of, or, you know, so it's not quite as gross as it looks. But there are obviously a lot of different experiments. Each of these experiments, at least of the ones that are planned, now some of these are past experiments too. Okay, so if I just say of the ones that are planned, QMAP, the VLA experiments, well, that's not really going to be useful, VSA, the VCA, most of the ones, yes, they would measure the first Doppler peak and even the second Doppler peak and some of the third Doppler peak. So, yeah, before math. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I say, from... Yeah, and I think one has to be careful with his argument. If one says, okay, here's an experiment which we're working on, and you know, if you just compare the numbers and say, statistically, what do you expect to see? Well, this is what you expect to see from MAP in the heavy dark, the black line, and this is what you expect to see from in our balloon experiment. Now, if you're just judging from this picture, you would say, okay, well, the answer is clear. But that's not the whole story at all. None of us believe that without actually getting the data set in hand. First of all, MAP is going to produce a full sky map of the sky with very nicely controlled systematic errors. Very quiet environment far away from the Earth. Okay, whereas balloon experiments are going to produce shorter time scale maps, which should be sufficient if all goes well, which so far things have gone pretty well. If we can just get to the same kind of sensitivity we've already gotten to, but on many more pixels. We're not asking for more sensitivity at this point at all. That's the interesting part. We actually have gotten beyond where we need to go.
What part of the sky do you look at in a balloon experiment?
Depends on the next generation of balloon experiments will measure up to 50% of the sky. Yeah. Depending on the way that they're mounted and the anywhere from 1% to 50% depending on how they're operated. Okay. So well, this is a continual process. I mean, there have been launches this year of experiments that might yield interesting data on it. There'll be launches next year. We're going to launch later this year. But there'll be an entire marching history over the next 5 years. And I think, I mean, it'd be very important to go play by play and see what happens. Already, I think, you know, we nicely agree on this. Well, we actually already saw this, you know, in say, 1992 or 93. We had evidence that there was already a rising of the spectrum. We didn't know that it was going to be what we saw. Now we go back and say, well, yeah, okay, all the data agrees now. Now that we see evidence for a fall in the spectrum, is that correct or not? I don't know. But if 5 years from now we go back and look at the data and all agrees, I would say, well, then there was some evidence in 1998. This kind of data you should see before MAP flies. Whether or not it'll do that well and there won't be systematic errors or problems, you know, can't say. But, you know, even if any one of the experiments falls in the ocean, there's three more waiting behind it, you know, from other groups to go. So.
Now, the general public perceives a race between this and the supernova. All right. So on the same time scale, how well can they can
They only measure one. Yeah, if you remember I think Saul presented a talk. I mean, you summarized, I think, some of it once before, and Kirshner gave another summary. Right. In theory, I mean, even they would have to say if the CMB goes the way, you know, it might go, then there won't be an issue. The CMB will win. But the supernova may get there because there are problems in the CMB data or there are foregrounds to be dealt with. Is there a race? The only time I heard there was a race is when I perceived Kirshner, you know, said there was a race. That's the first time I heard that. I mean, I think they're jumping the gun by publishing in the New York Times.
Right.
You know, I didn't perceive that as a race, but, you know, maybe there is.
This is a question from a student, by the way.
Oh, yeah. there was one experiment that looked like it had really terrific
idea of hiring. No. I don't know, there's some crazy graduate student here working on that. I don't know. Is he still here? The graduate student in our group was working on an experiment. We muse in different ways about what one can do. Sometimes one has to be careful with musings that they don't get taken too seriously. In theory, we can fly an experiment on a balloon which will reconstruct the power spectrum like this. I will say it's technologically possible. Whoever asked the question, right? It's your friend, right? it's technologically possible to do. Whether we can carry it off and do it, you know, in the way it should be done, I can't say it. But it is technologically possible. One doesn't have to go into space to get the sensitivity. Whether one has to go in space to beat back everything else, I don't know yet. Although, what I can say is we've already gotten down to the 10 microkelvin scale from the South Pole. And you don't have to even get that low to do this experiment extremely well. I mean, if we had 10 microkelvin, but multiplied by, say, 50,000 pixels, you would get this kind of answer with the right beam size. I think, you know, you have to be a little bit careful. I mean, it is possible whether it's going to be done in other ways.
Another question? Susan, seeing a vehicle? Oh,
yeah. Susan, go ahead. I'm not just going to take another round of course. Where's the
one? Same. So they might collide, but.
But that's the first one.
I'm sorry?
That's the first one.
Yeah, it's called L2. They're both going to the same place. But L2 is a big place to go to, so. I'm not worried about collisions.